It's always a great pleasure to substitute in this pulpit when Gary is involved somewhere else, as he is today. As for my remarks this morning, I have a special request. You are always good listeners, but because the sermon will include some unconventional material, I'm going to beg you to think along with me even more carefully than usual. You may want to pretend that you're in a classroom and an exam will follow immediately after. In that hope, let's begin. The public servant I refer to in this morning's sermon, What the Judge Didn't Know, is that Alabama Supreme Court justice who lost his fight to keep a 2-ton granite monument of the Ten Commandments in the rotunda of the state judicial building. He has an appeal pending, but my interest is not in that ongoing legal battle. It's rather in the widespread assumption by Christians that those laws did not exist among nations until the Jewish God, whose name was Yahweh, gave them to Moses in a spectacular setting of thunder, lightning, fire, and smoke at the top of a quaking desert mountain. Two recent letters in the Eagle's opinion line are typical of how conservative Christians read that ancient story. One writer says the Ten Commandments are, quote, the absolute laws given by God to govern human behavior, and calls them perfect, while another is positive that God might take it personally if his laws are not posted in government offices. Both letters clearly reflect a popular sense that those ten are preeminent among the hundreds of other biblical commandments. It's interesting, however, that when Jesus was asked about the commandments, he said simply that they are all summed up in these two: love God and love your neighbor. No sermon recorded in the Christian New Testament features the dramatic story of Mount Sinai and the stone tablets, probably because the understanding of God's nature had changed considerably by that time. Case in point, the Mosaic God, whose name they knew as Yahweh, begins the list of ten by saying he is a jealous God, and if anyone worships another god, quote, I will punish them and their children to the third and fourth generations. Not enough for this god to punish the original offenders, but their children, their grandchildren, and even their great-grandchildren must be punished as well. Not quite the compassionate and forgiving Father Jesus liked to talk about. And this ancient deity also says, thou shalt not kill, although the Genesis story has him killing everyone on earth except Noah and his family during the flood, while the Exodus story has him killing the innocent firstborn son, not just of the stubborn Pharaoh, but of every single Egyptian family when the Hebrews made their famous escape from slavery. The Hebrew author puts it quite matter-of-factly. At midnight, the Lord killed all the firstborn sons in Egypt, from the king's son, who was heir to the throne, to the son of the prisoner in jail. And there was loud crying throughout Egypt. One would think so. If you have or hope to have a firstborn child whom you love dearly, you can surely imagine the incredible horror and anguish of such a night. Nor did the command, "You shall not kill," keep Moses from ordering the assassination of 3,000 of his countrymen as soon as he came down the mountain to find them worshiping an idol in the shape of a golden calf. When I heard the exuberant and well-deserved praise of my beloved friend Bob Scott a few minutes ago, I thought of this command and worried a little. And finally, the chauvinistic bias of ancient Hebrew life is shown in the command that one shall not covet his neighbor's property, a word immediately defined to mean his house, his livestock, his wife, or anything else that he owns. Do those who stress the absolute and perfect nature of the Ten Commandments also believe that wives are property? Something too easily overlooked is that at the same time the Hebrew God gives the Ten Commandments, he goes on to expand and explain them in ways so foreign to our culture that we completely ignore much of what he says. For example, one of the ten on the Alabama Judges Monument says we must honor our parents. But when that is defined in the biblical story, as it is in the verses following, we learn that not only is the child who physically hits his father or mother to be killed, but verbal abuse of them also carries the death penalty. Well, all of us disapprove of disrespectful children. But if we now applied that law literally, we'd have a mass extermination of teenagers. You may be interested to know, by the way, that the laws of our congregational ancestors in New England also demanded the death penalty for any children over 16 who struck or reviled their parents, unless, because they actually softened the old law a little, unless the parents had been so negligent or cruel that the kids were in danger of being maimed or killed. Here are some other laws given along with the ten and with the same divine sanction, although they do not get the same respect today. This one, for example: each firstborn creature, animal or human, belongs to me, the Hebrew God says, explaining that you can buy back a son, daughters are not mentioned, of course, and you can buy back the firstborn of a donkey, an especially valuable commodity, but if you don't buy back the donkey's life, you have to break its neck. We pay little attention to that one anymore. This law is given, however, at the same time and place as are the Ten Commandments and with Yahweh's undisputed authority. But cultural changes have guaranteed it won't be displayed on a public monument. Nor would this one. You dare not make an altar of hewn stone, because if you use a chisel on it, you profane it. The writer doesn't bother to tell us why the Hebrew God did not like chisels. And the priest, wearing a short apron, somewhat similar, it seems, to Scottish kilts, must not go up by steps to that altar, lest his people see that he is not wearing Hanes. you can read it, all except for the word Haynes. I chose a nicer word. It's an interesting piece of advice given directly by the same God who gave the ten, but no longer relevant to modern life and therefore consigned to oblivion. And you should watch biblical scholars at work trying to figure out what the Hebrew God Yahweh means when he says, "You shall not boil a lamb in its mother's milk." I wrestled with that one for far too many days before I finally gave up. So how do we determine which laws have eternal validity and which reflect contemporary culture at the time they were written and therefore have become outdated? And since we've come now to the matter of acculturation, the influence of surrounding social patterns, it's time to remind ourselves of something very important in the interpretation of biblical stories, that those Ten Commandments and other laws given at the same time, listen carefully, were by no means new in the world. The story in Exodus gives no hint that they are derivative, old hat. But most of what the God Yahweh is said to have revealed to Moses on Mount Sinai had been common knowledge and civic law for many centuries. This was true in the Babylonian homeland of Abraham, father of the Jewish people, and it was true in the land of Canaan, where the Jews had lived long before the time of Moses. So why does Hebrew Scripture suggest that their God made a dramatic trip to planet Earth, especially designed for his elect people? How literally should we read that narrative? Let's look for some answers by going back hundreds of years before the biblical story to a civilization much more sophisticated than the one Moses was trying to create. Civilization as it had developed in a land called Babylonia. No trouble now in locating the country because we're reading about it every day under its present name of Iraq. Do you remember how upset historians were when their world-famous museum was looted in the early days of our invasion? Fortunately, the most priceless relic of all was safe in the Louvre in Paris. A shaft of black granite 2 feet taller than I am, discovered by French archaeologists 100 years ago. Priceless because in the wedge-shaped writing called cuneiform, its 3,600 lines lay out the ancient laws of Hammurabi, the most famous of all the Babylonian kings. Not only do many of those laws anticipate by several hundred years the laws of Moses, but there is another parallel, even more fascinating. At the top of one side of this stone pillar, a carved figure of Hammurabi shows him receiving those laws from Shamash, the sun god, judge of heaven and earth for the Babylonians, just as Yahweh would be later for the Hebrew people. Now, do I believe the king actually got those laws from a god? No, but I believe that he or those who wrote about him understood how important it was to have divine sanction. Laws needed to have divine sanction. They needed to be the gift of a god rather than the words of a mere mortal. or people might not obey them. The historical truth is that the laws of Moses did not suddenly come out of nowhere. The similarities between those laws and the centuries older code of Hammurabi are too striking to be an accident. Both have very specific laws about how to treat slaves, about the difference between intentional and accidental homicide, about the death penalty for kidnapping, about disobedient children. Both sets of laws make the city gates the place where justice is decided. Both require the same punishment for false witness, slander, and injuries to pregnant women. The Mosaic Code, formulated much later, is sometimes more and sometimes less compassionate than the earlier one. As an example of less compassion, where the Code of Hammurabi sets the length of service for slaves at 3 years, the Mosaic Law doubles it to 6. In one famous example of parallelism between the ancient Babylonian code and the much later law of Moses, laws about oxen are so prominent and so specific that it's all but impossible to doubt the influence of the first story on the second. Words like these, you can read them in the Old Testament, you can read them in the Code of Hammurabi. The Babylonian code said that if an ox gores a person to death, the ox is to be killed. But the owner is not punished for this crime, except by the loss of his property. But if the ox has gored people in the past, it's beginning to sound like Wichita's latest dog law, if the ox has gored people in the past and the owner was warned but failed to keep it chained, then both the ox and the owner are killed. These are the divinely revealed words of Shamash, the sun god, as given to King Hammurabi, and hundreds of years later they became the words of Yahweh, the thunder god of Mount Sinai, to Moses and the people of Israel. This is not a secret, guarded only in seminaries. Anyone who takes time to read can see the astonishing similarities between the two. What it all means is that laws about morality and slaves and capital punishment and damage to property existed long before Moses put a new Hebrew stamp on some old originals. I do not wish for a moment to leave the impression that all those laws described in the book of Exodus are to be lightly dismissed, but it's obvious that we have made rational decisions about which ones still apply and how they apply. For example, while it's clear that some of them fit easily into Christian faith, others do not, and we have worked out accommodations. If the absolute and perfect nature of the Mosaic laws mean they should be enshrined in government buildings, it would call upon the secular state to punish citizens who worship any god but Yahweh, or use profanity, or plead the necessity of working on Sundays. The priceless gift of reason helps us know how to make use of Jewish and Christian histories presented in the Bible. When the God of Moses boasts that he, I'm quoting directly, will do such miracles as have never been seen in all the world, and says, I will drive out the native people and give you their land, we have the right to ask whether bragging and ethnic cleansing on such a scale are really traits of an eternal God, or whether they are the remnants of a childish imagination and a rationale for seizing somebody else's homeland for your own. I'm trying to say to you that reading Hebrew Scripture is not as simple as people like Judge Ray Moore of Alabama would have us believe. And I, for one, am grateful that federal judges recognize the danger of having government endorse one religion over another in a nation of great diversity. What do you suppose the judge and his supporters would say if words from Muhammad or the Buddha, no matter how true or useful, were to be carved into stone and brought into the rotunda of state or federal buildings? I think you know. The judge's ultimate ambition is to end the separation of church and state, and so he has an appeal in process. For the good of this country, I have to hope he loses.